Nobody professed to understand the question of the frozen railroad bonds. Perhaps because everybody understood it too well. At first there had been signs of a panic among the bondholders, and of a dangerous indignation among the public. Then Wesley Mooch had issued another directive, which ruled that people could get their bonds defrozen upon a plea of essential need. The government would purchase the bonds if it found the proof of the need satisfactory. There were three questions that no one answered or asked. What constituted proof? What constituted need? Essential to whom? Then it became bad manners to discuss why one man received the grant defreezing his money while another had been refused. People turned away in mouth-pinched silence if anybody asked a why. One was supposed to describe, not to explain, to catalog facts, not to evaluate them. Mr. Smith had been defrozen, Mr. Jones had not, that was all. And when Mr. Jones committed suicide, people said, well, I don't know, if he'd really needed his money, the government would have given it to him. But some men are just greedy. One was not supposed to speak about the men who, having been refused, sold their bonds for one-third of the value to other men who possess needs which miraculously made 33 frozen cents melt into a whole dollar, or about a new profession practiced by bright young boys just out of college who called themselves defreezers and offered their services to help you draft your application in the proper modern terms. The boys had friends in Washington. Looking at the Taggart rail from the platform of some country station, she had found herself feeling not the brilliant pride she had once felt, but a foggy, guilty shame, as if some foul kind of rust had grown on the metal, and worse, as if the rust had a tinge of blood. But then in the concourse of the terminal she looked at the statue of Nat Taggart and thought, it was your rail, you made it, you fought for it. You were not stopped by fear or by loathing. I won't surrender it to the men of blood and rust, and I'm the only one left to guard it. She had not given up her quest for the man who invented the motor. It was the only part of her work that made her able to bear the rest. It was the only goal in sight that gave meaning to her struggle. There were times when she wondered why she wanted to rebuild that motor. What for? Some voice seemed to ask her. Because I'm still alive, she answered. But her quest had remained futile. Her two engineers had found nothing in Wisconsin. She had sent them to search through the country for men who had worked for 20th Century, to learn the name of the inventor. They had learned nothing. She had sent them to search through the files of the patent office. No patent for the motor had ever been registered. The only remnant of her personal quest was the stub of the cigarette with the dollar sign. She had forgotten it until a recent evening when she found it in a drawer of her desk and given it to her friend at the cigar counter of the concourse. The old man had been very astonished as he examined the stub, holding it cautiously between two fingers. He had never heard of such a brand, and wondered how he could have missed it. Was it of good quality, Miss Taggart? The best I've ever smoked. He had shaken his head, puzzled. He had promised to discover where those cigarettes were made and to get her a carton. She had tried to find a scientist able to attempt the reconstruction of the motor. She had interviewed the men recommended to her as the best in their field. The first one, after studying the remnants of the motor and of the manuscript, had declared in the tone of a drill sergeant that the thing could not work, had never worked, and he would prove that no such motor could ever be made to work. The second one had drawled in the tone of an answer to a boring imposition that he did not know whether it could be done or not, and did not care to find out. The third had said, his voice belligerently insolent, that he would attempt the task on a 10-year contract at $25,000 a year. After all, Miss Taggart, if you expect to make huge profits on that motor, it's you who should pay for the gamble of my time. The fourth, who was the youngest, had looked at her silently for a moment, and the lines of his face had slithered from blankness into a suggestion of contempt. You know, Miss Taggart, I don't think that such a motor should ever be made, even if somebody did learn how to make it. It would be so superior to anything we've got that it would be unfair to lesser scientists, because it would leave no field for their achievements and abilities. I don't think that the strong should have the right to wound the self-esteem of the weak. She had ordered him out of her office and had sat in incredulous horror before the fact that the most vicious statement she had ever heard had been uttered in a tone of moral righteousness. The decision to speak to Dr. Robert Stadler had been her last recourse. She had forced herself to call him against the resistance of some immovable point within her that felt like brakes slammed tight. She had argued against herself. She had thought, I deal with men like Jim and Oren Boyle. His guilt is less than theirs. Why can't I speak to him? She had found no answer, only a stubborn sense of reluctance, only the feeling that of all the men on earth, Dr. Robert Stadler was the one she must not call. As she sat at her desk over the schedules of the John Galt line, waiting for Dr. Stadler to come, she wondered why no first-rate talent had risen in the field of science for years. She was unable to look for an answer. She was looking at the black line, which was the corpse of train number 93 on the schedule before her. A train has the two great attributes of life, she thought, motion and purpose. This had been like a living entity, but now it was only a number of dead freight cars and engines. Don't give yourself time to feel, she thought. Dismember the carcass as fast as possible. The engines are needed all over the system. Ken Daniger in Pennsylvania needs trains, more trains, if only. Dr. Robert Stadler, said the voice of the inter-office communicator on her desk. He came in smiling. The smile seemed to underscore his words. Miss Taggart, would you care to believe how helplessly glad I am to see you again? She did not smile. She looked gravely courteous as she answered, It was very kind of you to come here. She bowed, her slender figure standing tautly straight, but for the slow, formal movement of her head. What if I confess that all I needed was some plausible excuse in order to come? Would it astonish you? I would not try to overtax your courtesy. She did not smile. Please sit down, Dr. Stadler. He looked brightly around him. I've never seen the office of a railroad executive. I didn't know it would be so solemn a place. Is that in the nature of the job? The matter on which I'd like to ask your advice is far removed from the field of your interests, Dr. Stadler. You may think it odd that I should call on you. Please allow me to explain my reason. The fact that you wish to call on me is a fully sufficient reason. If I can be of any service to you, any service whatever, I don't know what would please me more at this moment. His smile had an attractive quality, the smile of a man of the world, who used it not to cover his words, but to stress the audacity of expressing a sincere emotion. My problem is a matter of technology, she said in the clear, expressionless tone of a young mechanic, discussing a difficult assignment. I fully realize your contempt for that branch of science. I do not expect you to solve my problem. It is not the kind of work which you do or care about. I should like only to submit the problem to you, and then I'll have just two questions to ask you. I had to call on you because it is a matter that involves someone's mind, a very great mind. And, she spoke impersonally, in the manner of rendering exact justice, and you are the only great mind left in this field. She could not tell why her words hit him as they did. She saw the stillness of his face, the sudden earnestness of the eyes, a strange earnestness that seemed eager and almost pleading. Then she heard his voice come gravely, as if from under the pressure of some emotion that made it sound simple and humble. What is your problem, Miss Taggart? She told him about the motor and the place where she had found it. She told him that it had proved impossible to learn the name of the inventor. She did not mention the details of her quest. She handed him photographs of the motor and the remnant of the manuscript. She watched him as he read. She saw the professional assurance in the swift, scanning motion of his eyes, at first, then the pause, then the growing intentness, then a movement of his lips which from another man would have been a whistle or a gasp. She saw him stop for long minutes and look off as if his mind were racing over countless sudden trails, trying to follow them all. She saw him leaf back through the pages, then stop, then force himself to read on as if he were torn between his eagerness to continue and his eagerness to seize all the possibilities breaking open before his vision. She saw his silent excitement. She knew that he had forgotten her office, her existence, everything, but the sight of an achievement. And in tribute to his being capable of such reaction, she wished it were possible for her to like Dr. Robert Stadler.